From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen.
I believe in mystery.
I believe in family.
I believe in being who I am.
I believe in the power of failure.
And I believe normal life is extraordinary.
This I believe.
Our This I Believe essay today was sent in by Kij Johnson of Seattle, Washington. She works at a software company by day and writes science fiction novels by night. But her belief is not about her work. It's about something deeper and darker, and about the way she rose above it. Here's our series curator, independent producer Jay Allison.
We are struck by how many of our contributors use their essays to talk about stories that even those close to them don't know. Kij Johnson chose to write about something she says will come as a surprise to many of her friends and coworkers, but that it was more important to say it than worry about it. Here is Kij Johnson with her essay for This I Believe.
I believe I am a climber. 3 years ago, a series of medical and personal crises took what was a clinical depression and made it something much darker. I thought of it as falling, as jumping, off a bridge on a rainy winter day, 3 seconds in the air before I hit the water and plunged deep into the icy cold, my heavy coat pulling me deeper, and the surface far overhead, too far away. This is the question that kept me from making the image a real one. What if I changed my mind? Jumping into the water, the air in my lungs would fail me before I could swim back to the living world. I would know for those last seconds that I did want to live after all, but it would be too late. I'm not sure why I started climbing. I walked through the door of the local climbing gym one day on a whim. It was an alien world. Strong, beautiful men and women, towering walls under sodium vapor lights, white dust filling the air, light instead of dark, up instead of down. It was in every way the opposite of what was inside me. The second time I climbed, I got to a move where I was sure I would fall. I was 25 feet up on a rope, but I didn't know yet that I could trust it. I heard my voice say out loud, I have a choice here, fear or joy. What I meant was, climb or don't climb, live or die. In the more than 2 years since then, I have climbed hundreds of days, inside and out, sometimes tied to a rope, often not. I do pay a price here. My body can be so bruised from hitting walls that people ask me about my home situation. 9 months ago, I broke my leg and ankle. I healed fast, but the risk remains. Next time I might not. Climbing requires a cold-blooded decision to live. If I am inattentive or careless, I will fall. Every time I climb at the gym, or rope up for a route outside, or go bouldering, which is climbing without a rope and often more dangerous, I am taking a risk, and I am committing to staying alive. Now I believe in climbing. In not jumping. Jumping would have been easy. Just step over the bridge railing and let go. Climbing is harder, but worth it. I believe that deciding to live was the right decision. There's no way to describe the terrible darkness of depression in a way that non-depressed people can understand. Now, I'm less focused on the darkness. Instead, I think about the joy I feel in conquering it. And the tool I used. I am a climber, and I am alive.
Kij Johnson with her essay for This I Believe. Since taking up climbing, Johnson has also tried out motorcycling, sea kayaking, badminton, and collage making. As always, we invite you to tell us the story of your belief. You can find information about submitting, along with all the essays, at npr.org. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Jay Allison is co-editor with Dan Gettiman, John Gregory, and Vicky Merrick of the book This I Believe, The Personal Philosophies of Remarkable Men and Women.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
Maybe It was this clip from The Simpsons that sent so many of you to your computers after last week's show.
So you like donuts, eh?
Uh-huh.
Well, have all the donuts in the world!
We promised you an interview on our blog with Paul Mullins, the author of the book Glazed America, A History of the Donut. He's actually on our website live as we speak. Go to npr.org/Sunday Soapbox, not only to tell us your favorite donut memories, but maybe to throw a question at our donut expert. And judging from this past week's response on our website, many of you have been caught in a sticky situation. We asked several of you to record your memories. Here's what Susan Sullivan of Newton, Massachusetts had to say.
My donut memory is from college. My friend Mitty would come to my room at around 3 a.m. to sing, Susan, donuts. I would emerge and we would eat. Once, however, she called, Susan, poetry. And we read from the complete works of E.E. Cummings that she had stolen from the library. I gained 10 pounds and remained an English major. I sometimes teach Cummings. Mitty is still my friend, but the donuts, not so much.
And here's Lloyd Allen of Atlanta, Georgia.
When our daughter Claire was 4, she became angry at my wife and me. She packed a little bag and came to tell us she was running away. When I asked her where she was going, she said she was going to Ron and Kathy's, our next-door neighbors, because they have donuts for breakfast every Saturday morning.
We also want to check in with a very special person who is celebrating his 92nd birthday today, NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. And Dan, I couldn't end the show without saying happy birthday to you.
Leanne, I wouldn't end my show if I didn't hear from you.
I want to ask you, though, do you have a donut story?
I don't have a donut story as such, but this being my birthday, can I substitute a bagel story?
Well, it's a pastry with a hole in it, sure.
Some 60 years ago, I used to travel a lot on assignment or for lectures and was checking at hotels and come down for breakfast and say, do you have a bagel? And frequently the waiter would say, what's that? And that went on for some time 60 years ago. But then over a period of time, 50 and 40 years ago, I found something changing. I found you can go to any hotel now and go into the breakfast room and say, do you have a bagel? And they say, well, of course. How do you want it, toasted or not toasted? And I think the arrival of the bagel in places which didn't used to know about bagels is a part of the celebration of my birthday.
Well, happy birthday, NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore.
Leanne, I thank you.
And to bring our story full circle, here's NPR Scott Simon with his 5-year-old daughter Elise for a little donut story of their own.
Baby, you can hear me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember what you used to call a donut?
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, what happens when we go to, when we walk into a place like Citarella's? What do you like to say?
I want a candy bagel.
Did you say I want a candy bagel?
Yes.
I tell you what, we're going to get some candy bagels tomorrow, okay?
Yay!
To send us your donut or candy bagel story, or to post your questions to Paul Mullins, author of the book Glazed America, A History of the Donut, go to our website, npr.org/soapbox. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
My friend the little sparrow flew close enough to see. Written on the rainbow is this philosophy. When you walk the streets, you'll have no cares. If you walk the lines and not the squares, as you go through life, make this your goal. Watch the donut, not the hole. Watch the donut, not the hole.
Next year will mark the bicentenary of the birth of one of the Republican Party's most popular presidents, Abraham Lincoln. To commemorate the event, a bronze cast of Lincoln and his horse, Old Bob, will adorn the front lawn of the Lincoln Cottage here in Washington, D.C. Today, it is the Armed Forces Retirement Home, but most local residents still refer to it as the Soldiers' Home, the name it was given in the 1850s. President Abraham Lincoln spent a lot of time there during his term of office. Robert Maleski visited the site to find out why.
For nearly a quarter of his presidency, Abraham Lincoln did not live in the White House. He lived here, in a large cottage on the 250-acre grounds of the Soldiers' Home. It was, in a sense, Lincoln's Camp David, and he used it well, staying from June to November, beginning in 1862. It's no wonder Lincoln wanted to get away from downtown Washington. If you've ever visited D.C. during the summer, you know just how hot and uncomfortable it can be. Sitting on the veranda of the Lincoln Cottage, director Frank Milligan says it wasn't just the heat.
There's one word that comes to mind, dust. Of course, in the other seasons, it was mud. So we're up high, we've got a nice breeze coming through, as you mentioned. There's very little dust. So all in all, only 3 miles away, but a world away.
The cottage itself is large, but not ostentatious. Clearly designed as a summer home, it's open and airy. Unlike Camp David, where no one gets past the gates without an appointment, Lincoln met many people here. Political friends, political enemies, convalescing soldiers, and even the occasional tourist. Historian Matthew Pinsker is the author of Lincoln's Sanctuary. Sitting in the parlor of the Lincoln Cottage, he relates one story about a well-connected British visitor named George Borrett, who was on a tour of the U.S. and wished to meet Lincoln.
He had tried to see the president in the White House and couldn't get in. It was too busy. And it turned out that the daughter of one of the assistant secretaries of Treasury said, "Oh, I know where the president stays in the summer. I'll take you there." It was late at night by the time they arrived. He says the butler tried to discourage them, but the daughter of the bureaucrat assured the butler that this visitor had come from England and he had to see the president. So the man went upstairs, and then they hear this clop, clop, clop down the steps, and it turns out to be the president in carpet slippers.
Here in the cottage, Lincoln didn't have to be just the chief executive. He could be the gracious host and family man as well. Matthew Pinsker believes the cottage served as a refuge that allowed Lincoln to grow into his job.
It gave him enough space to calm down and see the war in a different perspective, and that long perspective made him a better leader. And the new encounters, escaping the iron cage of the White House, all of that just makes him a better, more informed, more engaged leader. By the summer of 64, he seems to be fully in command over his rivals, his friends, his enemies. He becomes the indispensable man of the war.
Lincoln couldn't help but see the war in a different perspective. Just a few hundred yards from the cottage is the Soldiers' Home National Cemetery. It was started in 1861, shortly after the Battle of Bull Run. Day by day, as the war dragged on, Lincoln could see men digging fresh graves.
I believe that when Lincoln was living among wounded veterans and looking into the eyes of these young soldiers who were risking their lives, and then living just a few hundred yards away from gravestones of soldiers who had given their lives, it made him realize that the stakes of the war were too high for the nation to be reunified without freedom being a central part of that reunification. They had to end slavery too.
So the cottage at the Soldiers' Home provided both an escape and a lens through which Lincoln was able to look at the war with a clarity he may not have been able to achieve otherwise. For that reason alone, the Lincoln Cottage was worth preserving and is worth a visit today. For NPR News, I'm Robert Maleski in Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. 20 years ago, in the summer of 1988, Yellowstone caught fire. The fires began in June and continued to burn until November, when winter snows extinguished the last blazes. Over the course of that summer and fall, more than 25,000 firefighters were brought in from around the country. In the end, the flames scorched about 1.2 million acres across the greater Yellowstone area, leaving the impression that the nation and the world's first national park had been destroyed. Scott McMillian reported for the Bozeman Daily Chronicle in Bozeman, Montana, for 20 years. One of his earliest assignments was covering the 1988 fires.
Yellowstone is a beloved icon. It was a celebrity fire in a celebrity place, and there was an impression that it was being allowed to burn to the ground.
The heightened media presence and the televised coverage of the fires horrified many people who believed that Yellowstone would be ruined forever. NPR reporter Alex Chadwick was in the park at the time of the fires, and he recorded this man's reaction.
This is just as though whoever was in charge of the crown jewels of England decided to take a sledgehammer and smash them up. You know, this is a national treasure, and they've just let it burn up.
But the doom and gloom prophecies about the destruction of Yellowstone proved to be wrong. In this first part of our series on Yellowstone National Park, we'll be looking at the history of the park and its resilience. Lee Whittlesey is Yellowstone's official historian. He's a small, wiry man, sporting a red plaid lumberjack shirt and an impish grin. We met him at the Yellowstone National Park Heritage Research Center in Gardner, Montana, just outside the north entrance to the park.
When Yellowstone was established in 1872, there were no other national parks anywhere on Earth, and Congress carved it out of territorial Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. So if you look at an 1872 map of the American West, you see the rectangle of Yellowstone National Park and nothing else for hundreds of miles. It's the oldest entity in this region.
Despite its remote location, the park quickly attracted a lot of attention. Even before it was officially established, it was called Wonderland, from Lewis Carroll's book Alice in Wonderland. Again, Lee Whittlesey.
By the late 1870s and early 1880s, everybody was referring to it as Wonderland this and Wonderland that. In the newspapers of this nation and the books and newspapers and magazines of Europe. And that was before the railroad even got here.
The first magazine article about Yellowstone appeared in 1871 and was titled The Wonders of the Yellowstone. It described the geysers, hot springs, mud pots, and steam vents, which were the original attractions in the park. These thermal features were unlike anything anyone had seen before, and they heightened people's curiosity. I'm standing in front of the Old Faithful geyser. This geothermal wonder is what attracted people to Yellowstone National Park and what makes it so unique. That fascination with Yellowstone hasn't changed much in the 136 years since the park's founding. It is peak tourist season, and hundreds of people line the boardwalk around Old Faithful, the park's most famous attraction. Those who have visited the park, and even those who have only seen pictures, consider it to be a national treasure and in need of protection, both from humans and from more natural threats, like fire. Yellowstone has survived many fires. Up until 1988, the park averaged at least one a year. Often, these were smaller fires that would go out on their own. Don Despain served as a research biologist with the National Park Service and helped to generate the fire management plans used by Yellowstone. In 1972, the park began trying something new.
We'd had a policy in place since 1972 that we would let certain fires burn as they would without any human interference as much as we could.
The fires allowed to burn were considered natural fires, those fires caused by lightning. Over the next 15 years, it proved to be a successful strategy, and the Park Service saw no reason to change it. But the summer of 1988 proved to be different from previous fire seasons. By June, Yellowstone was already in a severe drought, despite higher-than-average rainfall in the spring. By mid-July, fires caused by lightning and human carelessness had consumed close to 17,000 acres in the park. No rain, low humidity, increasing winds, and a lot of very dry pine needles and fallen branches all constituted what then Park Superintendent Bob Barbee called attention getters. The let it burn policy was put on hold.
We went into a suppression mode of putting things out as much as we could. We still didn't anticipate anything like what was to come.
By the end of July, the larger fires had become nearly uncontrollable. Public sentiment was that the Park Service had failed to do its job. But according to Bob Barbee, the situation was unavoidable.
No matter what we would have done, the conditions were such that there were going to be great fires in Yellowstone under any circumstances. And they were started by lightning, they were started by outfitters, they were started by woodcutters. We were a perfect setup to burn.
The worst day of the 1988 fires came on August 20th, known as Black Saturday. High winds propelled the extremely hot and fast-burning fires across more than 150,000 acres, practically doubling the amount of land that had already burned. By this point, the national media had turned their full attention to events in Yellowstone, and according to Lee Whittlesey, the park's historian, they may have overreacted.
"Our heritage tonight is burning," I seem to recall one newscaster dramatically intoning, and that was a little much.
Local residents were worried. The fires were only a few miles away, and they seemed dangerously out of control. At town hall meetings in West Yellowstone, Montana, at the west entrance of the Park Service, and especially Bob Barbie, bore the brunt of people's frustration.
You know, folks kept saying, well, why don't you people just put those fires out? It just doesn't work that way. And the strategy is not putting the fires out, but managing them, herding them. You don't go in and put out these huge fires.
What many in the media and in the general public failed to understand at the time was that fire, even fire of this magnitude, was necessary to maintain the overall health of Yellowstone's ecosystem. Lodgepole pines, tall, skinny trees with branches near the top, or crown, dominate most of Yellowstone's landscape. Some of their pine cones are sealed with a waxy resin and only open once temperatures reach above 113 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, the trees require fire in order to reproduce. Again, Bob Barbie.
Fire is as important to the great lodgepole ecosystems of the Northern Rockies as sunshine and rain. And so the forest recycle itself quickly. And now if you go to Yellowstone, you'll see a carpet of green. The forest is fully recovering, and we don't characterize the fire as causing damage to the park.
And he's right. The 1988 fires changed Yellowstone, but didn't destroy it. Seedlings began to appear as early as 1989, and now there are healthy and green 20-year-old trees covering the park. The fires also provided a sort of living laboratory for scientists to learn about how ecosystems recover. More than 250 fire-related research projects have been conducted in the past two decades, examining the fire's impact on wildlife, water, and vegetation. Over the next few weeks, as our series on Yellowstone continues, we'll learn about what ecologists discovered from the 1988 fires. We'll also talk to people about their personal experiences and look ahead to the future of the park and its surrounding ecosystem. Our series is produced by Laura Kranz. Sarah Palin's childhood home faces Alaska's Talkeetna Mountains. In the spring, purple violets, Indian paintbrush, and wild geraniums carpet the mountain's alpine tundra in a bloom of color. In winter, the snow-covered mountains take on a rose blush in the soft alpenglow. Sarah could see these mountains from the front porch of the family's little house near downtown Wasilla. These mountains would become like other wild places in Alaska, a place of sustenance and renewal for her boisterous and busy family. That's an excerpt from Sarah, How a Hockey Mom Turned Alaska's Political Establishment Upside Down, a biography of Sarah Palin published this spring. The author, Kayleen Johnson, joins me now. She's a longtime Alaskan herself and lives in Wasilla, Alaska. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Leanne. Thank you.
Was Sarah Palin born in Alaska?
She was born in Sandpoint, Idaho, but she moved to Alaska with her family when she was just 2 months old. So she is a lifelong Alaskan.
Tell us about her life growing up in Wasilla. And it's a town that you write back in 1974 had only 400 residents?
That's right. She grew up in Wasilla. It started out as a small community of 400, but by the time she became the mayor, it was closer to 4,000. And it's doubled that since then. So this is very much a growing community.
And what kind of town was it? I mean, how did Sarah, you know, occupy her time?
Her father was a school teacher, and in the summertime, he would take the television, unplug it, and put it away. And instead, he put out a basketball hoop out in the yard, and the kids were to be out active and be out playing and using their imagination. So they did a lot of hiking. They did a lot of berry picking. They did a lot of basketball, And so that's how they spent their time, was outdoors.
But you write that Sarah was an avid reader.
That's right. She would read the paper from cover to cover from a very young age, which her sisters both thought was rather odd. But she's always been interested in current events, and I think that's probably what led her to her degree in journalism, and that with a minor in political science.
Sarah Palin is an evangelical Christian, and in one passage you write, Sarah took the commitment she made to God as a youngster seriously, even through high school. She signed yearbooks with Bible verses, held fast to the New Testament admonition from 1 Thessalonians 5:17, which says, "Be joyful always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances." Can you tell us more about her faith and how this informed her?
Well, I think it really shapes who she is. Her mother grew up Catholic, and she grew up Catholic for part of that time, and then her mother, Sally, really found a more meaningful path through the Wasilla Assembly of God Church and started taking her family there. And I think over the course of time and through Bible school and their involvement in church there, I think that Sarah eventually embraced those ideals and beliefs as her own.
She was called Sarah Barracuda on the basketball. Why was she called that?
Well, she's fiercely competitive, and she's also a very hard worker. Her father was actually a coach for track and cross country, the teams she was on. And what he said was what she lacked in raw talent, she made more than made up for in hard work. And I think that work ethic was something that she took with her wherever she, in whatever endeavors she undertook.
Her involvement in politics, she began on the Wasilla City Council. She later became mayor. Tell us a little bit about that involvement, why she did it, and how she made it happen.
Well, she was invited by a fellow council member to run for the council, and I think this person that invited her assumed that she would be a team player and get on board and just sort of go along with the flow. And she would tell you that they didn't realize that she wasn't quite wired that way. She did run for the city council. She won. And she really saw that, you know, it was a bit of a club and a bit of a boys' network, and she really didn't like how business was being done on the city council. So she fought City Hall, if you will, and it made some impressions and it made some people mad. And in the end, she decided that, you know, if there was really going to be change in the government of this community, it had to come from the top. So she ran for mayor and won.
You paint a picture of Governor Sarah Palin and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin as being a very strong woman. You've talked a lot about her strengths. What would you say her weaknesses are?
You know, I'm really at a loss. You know, I went into writing the book a bit of a skeptic, I have to say. You know, I've just been jaded with politics in Alaska in particular, and I went into it a bit of a skeptic, but I came out feeling pretty hopeful, you know, that this is one of those people that, you know, really is different.
In your introduction, you write, "The biggest mistake her adversaries make is underestimating her."
I think that's absolutely the case. She comes across as an average American, and she is, and as an average mom, and she is, but she's also extraordinary. She's very strong-willed. She stands, I think, on principle more than she stands on party, and that has gotten her into a lot of hot water in the Republican Party in Alaska in the past. So I think that in some ways she's very ordinary, in other ways she's very extraordinary.
Kayleen Johnson is the author of Sarah, How a Hockey Mom Turned Alaska's Political Establishment Upside Down, a biography of Sarah Palin, the Republican vice presidential nominee. Kayleen Johnson joined us from Wasilla, Alaska. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne.
Now to a tale set in Minnesota. The Sorrows of an American by Siri Husvedt. The novel begins when a brother and sister, Eric and Inga Davidson, uncover a mysterious letter amid their late father's papers. The letter is dated June 27, 1937.
"Dear Lars, I know you will never ever say nothing about what happened. We swore it on the Bible. It can't matter now she's in heaven or to the ones here on earth. I believe in your promise. Lisa."
From there, the novel becomes a quest for the past. Now, we don't want to give away just what the family secret is. For that, you'll have to read the book. But the story, according to Siri Husvedt, is about much more.
"Even more than the letter, Eric begins a search for the depths of his father, and I think in some way he begins to find his father in himself. So there's a theme of being occupied or inhabited by other people even when they're dead.
Mm-hmm. It was fascinating the way you used your own father's unpublished memoir in this book. He was a descendant of Norwegian immigrants, and life was very hard. And tell us more about him.
Well, he grew up on a farm during the Depression, and the farm was actually ruined by the Depression. They couldn't make a go of it. They lost part of their land, and this story became, I think, a real grief for my own father. He carried it with him his whole life, and he was certainly the model for Lars Davidson in the book.
Let's have you, if you would please, read a little bit from his memoir, which you use so seamlessly in your own text. It really takes us back to a grim time. This is not Garrison Keillor's mirthful Norwegian context. This is something
bachelor
else.
Bachelor farmers, no, mm-hmm. This is something a little different. Looking back at our early life, the most astonishing feature must be how small our house was. A kitchen, living room, and bedroom on the first floor came to 476 square feet. Two lofts on the second floor, which were used as bedrooms, provided the same amount of floor space. There was no furnace. A wood-burning range warmed the kitchen, and a heater cared for the living room. Except for storm windows, the house had no insulation. The water in the tea kettle was often frozen by morning. One winter in the early 1930s, we ran out of wood. If one must burn green wood, ash and maple will serve you best.
You know, as I was reading that, I kept thinking that it was something out of the 19th century, not the 20th century.
It's true. And actually, I think a form of 19th century prairie life went on much longer in that particular part of Minnesota than many other places. My father also grew up speaking Norwegian, and he spoke English with a Norwegian accent until the day he died, which is amazing considering he was a third-generation Norwegian-American.
Eric, your protagonist, is looking for old family secrets, but something more as well. He suspects that his father may have been, is the word pronounced, a fugger?
Fugger is an old word, but it is something that does still exist in the psychiatric literature. It's now called dissociated fugue states. This was something that got a lot of play in the 19th century in medicine, and it was men, always men, who would suddenly vanish from their homes, run off, and forget who they were. This is not actually the case with the father. But he does go out on fugues. He walks, and that is a kind of escape. And by the end of the book, Eric begins to understand, I think, a bit more why he walked.
One of your reviewers, you know, thinking about everything that you have knit together here, there are a number of subplots, but the action does go back and forth between Minnesota and New York, between the past and the present. One of your reviewers said, America is a large and strange country. And I thought that you really captured that strangeness here.
It is a large and strange country. And I think I wanted to bring into this book that richness that also exists in American life. And since I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, very much like my two sister and brother characters in the novel, that small town world hasn't completely vanished. And people are doing very strange and interesting and complex things all over the place. And there are these two women in the book who make dolls. And those dolls are very peculiar because they all have something wrong with them. They're all wounded or damaged in some way.
And Eric and Inga, his sister, ask the doll maker if what comes first, the story or the doll?
And she says that the story always comes first. So the implication is that these two women are making images of actual people who have lived these stories. One is a little girl. She's on crutches and has a cast. And there's another doll that is sitting in a chair in overalls. It's a man. and he's holding a letter in his hand, and the letter is a letter about his son's death in the Second World War.
American Gothic.
A bit, yes.
And our mystery is revealed. One of the many mysteries in here is revealed in these dolls. We won't say what that is, but I'd like you to just leave us, if you would, with some of that humor from the Scandinavian plains, and on the 80th birthday of Eric's father, Lars Davidson, he makes a speech. The speech he makes, I think, is a real testament to the perseverance of that previous generation of settlers.
Yes, it's true, and I have to say that I stole this directly from my own father at his 80th birthday. So this is how he began his speech. "I read a small ad in the newspaper not so long ago," he said, "that went like this. Lost cat, brown and white, thinning fur, torn left ear, blind in one eye, missing tail, limps on front right foreleg. Answers to the name of Lucky."
Siri Husvedt. Her latest novel is called The Sorrows of an American. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.